thought was a turn in the war towards imperialism, which really probably he knew was in there in the beginning. He then became anti-war about the situation. So we are picking up with progressivism, and we were working on our finished 38, talking about muckraking journalists, listed their names and their titles of their works and the subjects that they related to. I want to come back and reemphasize that these writers, in fact, I didn't mention this before, most of these writers, their books were first serialized in magazines, which you will not have to know the names of, but they include things like Metropolitan and McClure's and Ladies' Home Journal and Harper's Bazaar. These, you know, some of these magazines you wouldn't think of being crusading investigative journalist magazines, but these are the ones they were first serialized and then later put into book form. One of the more radical ones was called The Masses. It was extremely left-leaning, but it's the one that took almost all of these books and published them because they were the ones that they felt were the hardest hitting. And so it's these writers that, in a sense, are putting yellow press journalism to good positive use that launches the call for, a grassroots call for reform. And if there is any watchwords or foundational ideas that the progressive reform movement is based on, they're listed in 39. That it is a period of believing that the more democracy you have, the more specialization you have, scientific specialization, and the more efficiency you have, things will work out grandiose. And at this point, I want to kind of just, I'm not exactly sure where I'm going. I'm going to kind of philosophically wander around and make some comments. But have we talked ever yet about the basic differences between what's liberal and conservative? I mean, let's kind of do that. There's two ways to look at this. What is, over the ages, a liberal attitude or conservative attitude, and what is a specific policy for a given century or decade? But if we start with the definition of what's a conservative, what's the root word that conservative comes from? Which would mean to keep things the way they are, to avoid as much change as possible. And so usually, traditionally, who is opposed to change? Pardon?
Old people.
Old people, or who else?
Republicans,
yeah.
Republicans.
It didn't show our work on that math. We just jumped right to the end of the problem there. But well, that's true. But the why is what we're working at. Why, in addition to older people, what other people? Wealthy. That's true. Wealthy and well-situated and comfortable. When things are going well for you, you don't want anybody screwing it up, messing it up, changing things. And traditionally, those who are not doing well and think that if things were made more fair or the system had a different chance put into it, I could have be there also. So liberals, therefore, favor change. That's one of the definitions, not the only one. Because the way I've started this off sounds pretty selfish, like those who have what they have don't want to give it up, and those who don't have it want to take it from someone else. And there's an aspect of there. That's a bit unfair. There are wealthy liberals, and there are poor conservatives. So it's not always just economic class that's a factor.
Also.
Currently,
when you talk about, you know, wealthy liberals, mm-hmm. they're those that maybe made their own money and didn't come to it through their parents.
I think that's a romantic image that we liberals like to claim in order to say that wealthy liberals have more heart and more compassion, but I wouldn't say it cuts across that way, because I think a lot of wealthy liberals, Kennedy-like people, inherited it from Uncle Joe, who made it in the selling of illegal liquor and stuff. Those kind of things. But that's a romantic ideal I like to promote. But the way I put it forward, it makes it look like it's just a selfish what's best for me or my group. And there are other reasons for liberal and conservative or for change and not change. And they can be ethical reasons, they can be religious reasons, they can be cultural reasons or race reasons, etc. But generally, it comes around that idea that when something works or is comfortable or seems appropriate, don't change it and lose it. And those who don't think it's fair or just or working or efficient, you want to change. Then you can put that into specific time periods and policies. Like in the beginning of our country, the traditional government-business relationship was one of mercantilism, one of where government and business worked together and promoted each other through big actions. And the idea of laissez-faire small government was really the outside radical liberal idea challenging the status quo. So Hamilton was the conservative, and Jefferson, who wanted laissez-faire, was the liberal challenger saying that Hamilton's mercantile policies are not good for the country and need to change. Today we would say the use of big government to promote economic policies is considered liberal, and small laissez-faire government attitudes are the conservatives. But that's because of the way the New Deal in the 30s changed things around. So specific policies in and of themselves aren't necessarily liberal or conservative. Another aspect of the liberal conservative thinking is whether, and this is where I'm going to use this in progressivism here, is whether a person's character is the product of environment or whether it's the way they were born. What's their nature versus their nurture? And I think that's probably the best way to ask yourself, because then you're not dealing with specific policies so much as you are human nature. To ask yourself, do you think people succeed or fail are because of what's available in the environment or because of their own lack of initiative or their work ethic? It's definitely both for me, I think. But if there's a tilt, 60 or 40 in any direction or more so, that might tell us something about our attitudes. Might also tell us something about our experiences, too. The extreme liberal attitude is, if you develop the right system or the wrong system, you can completely reshape a person's character. That's where liberals go, the idea of how much the environment makes the difference. So it's not surprising that progressives, who are liberals, liberal reformers, would suggest the problem with America is not people. People are malleable. The problem is the systems are unfair or unjust. Monopoly politics monopoly businesses and corrupt political machines. So if we could repair and get the right technical system put into place, then people's character's best portion would come out and people would operate together. So that's where I'm going with the democracy, specialization, and efficiency. The belief was if you could run this like a scientific project, or run it like a machine on physics principles, and base it on democracy that all people are equal, it would have to turn out right. You could look at reform. It's definitely that. I was going to make the link there that where I was going to go was, who took that to extremes was Soviet Russia. Based on Marxism, exactly that idea. The Soviets, ultra-liberals, believed that everything was based on environment. And when you had supposed, which it wasn't, but it's a supposed perfect Marxist system in place in the Soviet Union, and people somehow had the audacity to be protesters, to protest the perfect system, what was the explanation? They were insane. You put them in mental hospitals. Who would argue with the perfect right system? It has to be... that they, if they can't be reformed by the Marxist-Soviet system, then they have a defect, and therefore they have to be retrained in the psychiatric wards. And so that explains why. So you might think that was some kind of like snide punishment. That was just how fanatic these Marxists were. They actually thought if you could reform the mental processes of people, they'd come to like the 5-year plan. Oh, yeah. Well, so that's one extreme. And, of course, in the other extreme, on the far conservative side, would be it has nothing to do with external environment. It's all whether or not you are of the right background, right race, right intelligence factor, et cetera. So that's how extreme things can go in that direction. Progressives weren't Marxists, but they were influenced by Marxist ideology, no doubt. In fact, I guess we could say that Marxism and new discoveries of physics and science and chemistry made it so the belief was if we can use science with environmental manipulation to create the perfect institutions, we can clean up all the corruption. And that's what's going to happen here, or at least that's what we're thinking as we go through these political reforms. And I still think that's part of liberal thinking today. I see it in the public schools, especially the idea that if you build just the right perfect system, you don't have to send kids to jail, send them to the public schools and they'll be reformed. Every once in a while it works.
So give them a perfect environment in a public school, and
in theory,
the environment is everyone should make it be at a minimum, right? But there's always that one loser kid who doesn't do anything. Is that why that doesn't work?
Well, I'm on. Since I'm on this and I work for the public schools, I'll have to measure my responses.
When you use the example of school system and stuff, they're only there for a certain amount of hours.
What is the greater influence? That's a good argument, that even if you did have the perfect institution from 8 to 3, if most of their life is spent in a climate and environment that teaches something else, and it doesn't mean negative either, where I can wander off on this. I've got this theory about students. Those who come from an upper income background, they have been brainwashed all their life. They have no choice but to be successful. So therefore, they could not handle failure. They couldn't even handle the idea of being working class. It's just beyond what they're allowed to become. so they have to go into the upper class profession with no choice. Just like maybe people who come from lower income backgrounds have been almost beaten down to the point where they don't believe they can get into higher income levels. So that environment can be much stronger at home in the community than the schools can overcome, even if you actually did have a school system that was perfect. So. Anyway, we're creating too much value here. We need to get back to memorizing things. So where this is going to go is that whenever we talk about a reform or a politician's plans or programs, it's likely that you'll see aspects of democracy, specialization, or scientific efficiency being touted as a reason for why it should work. Some drew their ideas from ergonomic specialist Frederick Taylor, who advanced the idea of Taylorism. Now, Taylor was not a political reformer. He was someone who advocated how to get more out of commercial production. Ideas of commercial production, how to get the best out of your workforce, how to get the best out of your machinery, what's the most efficient ways to set up work hours and workstations, and even like the shape of machines, ergonomically speaking. And Taylor was not just studied by business owners, but also governments and schools, et cetera, all said if we can become more efficient, like Taylor suggests, we'll produce a better product, meaning better student, or better city services. Of the political reforms that existed, one of the first areas we'll go to has to do with city machines and bosses. Now, we talked about this before when we studied immigrants and urban life in the city, where we talked about the Eastern European immigrants after the 1890s coming into the major northeastern cities. They were very useful for keeping the same group of cronies or machine politicians in power. And it was the old classic, we'll deliver on city services, you deliver the vote, and everybody's getting what they deserve, in a sense or
what. Boss Tweed?
Boss Tweed was the best of New York City's Tammany Hall. Another machine that, or I guess you'd say Chicago machine, lasted all the way up until now, or the 1960s, with Richard Daley of Chicago being one of the best powerful bosses. His son, Richard Daley Jr., is, I guess, not as in the same mode the father was, but he kept power and consolidated control and policy making in Chicago for centuries. And the reason these, there's a couple of reasons why these machines and leaders stay in power. One is that they frighten and scare away competitors. They bribe or intimidate anybody that tries to challenge their rule. So all people who get jobs because the machine has made it possible for them. At election time, they offer the right favors, or they stuff the right ballot boxes, or make sure the tombstones are voting. So those were techniques used in the past. All of that's not democratic. It's not efficient, or at least efficient for them, but it's not considered efficient for good services. You may have seen on the test we had last time something I did not lecture. It was a wrong answer anyway, but Goo Goos is an answer. You've seen that? Goo Goos was a derisive nickname against those who wanted to see good governments, where the term comes from. Good government meaning honest government that is not under the control of these corrupt bosses. And usually most of the city dwellers who needed the most help, especially these immigrants, hated these reform government people because their solutions were get rid of the corruption and go back to laissez-faire, which would have meant the services wouldn't be coming their ways. So the fact that these bosses delivered services is what kept them in order, kept them in power. Two particular techniques adopted to try to reform corrupt city politics were in 42, the commission form of government and the city manager form. The commission form worked on the idea that you hire a group of experts, one to work on sanitation, one with a specialty in maybe fire or a water department or police, criminal justice, people who in all aspects of running a city maybe college graduates with a degree in that area, and therefore you put a commission of experts together to plan city policy. That fits exactly the idea of specialization and efficiency.
To reform city policy.
Get rid of the old corrupt machine and bosses and put these technical experts into place.
So hire experts,
right? Hire experts in given fields to run all the aspects of municipal government. What you'll find really is by the 1930s, this idea moves to the national level. FDR will be the first to do this. And when he recruits experts, college-trained experts, to come and handle foreign affairs or to handle criminology at the national level, it'll be called the brain trust when it comes to that point. And that's still a technique we use. For example, why was Henry Kissinger, or not why, but what credentials did Henry Kissinger have that made him available to be Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, as well as Condoleezza Rice now? The degrees, and the schools that came. She came from Stanford, and I think he came from, was it Harvard or Cornell? One of the, maybe Princeton, it was one of those Ivy League schools that, so that, I mean, when you have those kind of top graduates from those top schools who are experts in foreign policy, your hopes are they'll know how to conduct foreign policy. And the same would be true for Robert Reich, who's Reich, I guess, that served in the Labor Department for Clinton. He was an expert in that field. So that idea of hiring experts in the field to run a certain division of government gets its start in the progressive era in this time period, starting at the city level. The other form, the city manager form, would be you'd still have a council and mayor, but you'd hire one expert, like we have in Fort Smith, so to speak. I mean, it's a city manager system who's trained in public administration, all aspects of it. State governments. This, what we're going to say in here in item 43 is how the idea of infusing more democracy into state governments would reform the system. With such ideas listed here is the referendum, recall, direct primary, and the initiative. And let me add one more that's on the test but not on the sheet, the Australian ballot, which we'll talk about.
Is it ballot?
Ballot, like a voting ballot.
Australian.
The Australian ballot, yes. This is 1900 to 1917, so the first 8 years of it will be Theodore Roosevelt. Next 4 years will be William Howard Taft, and then there'll be Woodrow Wilson from 19. So 1901 to 1909 is Theodore Roosevelt. 1909 to 1913 is Taft, and then 1913 to 1921 will be Wilson. And now that you brought that up, let me kind of just comment on something I had written here, but I couldn't read anymore, and you've reminded me what it is, and that is, who are some of the important governors at this time period who became famous as progressive reformers? Theodore Roosevelt of New York's an example, of course, later president. Hiram Johnson of California, famous reform governor. Hiram Johnson pioneered the recall movement in California, which we'll talk. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Oh, no, when we get to recall, we will.
Was Roosevelt the only mayor of New York to win?
I can't think of any others. Mayor of Buffalo was Cleveland, but not New York. His third-party candidate, Lindsay, did in the 70s, but I can't think of any. But I'll be haunted all night trying to. Mayors of New York. Al Smith was governor of New York. Roosevelt was governor. I think they're all governors rather than mayors. New York governor, in fact, Charles Evans Hughes, really famous reformer. Charles Evans Hughes pioneered much of these movements we talked about in 43 in New York. And he'll have an interesting career to him because Hughes is a governor of New York, eventually will become a justice on the Supreme Court in the teens. He will leave the Supreme Court in 1916 to run for president against Wilson and lose. Hughes will be the last bearded presidential candidate or major party presidential candidate. Bearded, yeah, that's the big... Why is that, or why is that important?
Well, in
my classroom at school, I have a picture of all the presidents from Washington up to Clinton. I can't find a Bush one yet. It's not on purpose. The company went broke during the Bush years, and I didn't get one. I'm not saying it's him that did it, but as we look at the presidents on the wall, the students always notice the change in fashion of the clothing as well as the facial hair. And I guess the bigger question is, why did politicians have facial hair, maybe? They start having facial hair. Who was our first president to do so?
Lincoln.
And they last from Lincoln until who's the last? Taft. So there's a time period in there from 1860 to about 1910 in which it was fashionable for people in power of business and politics and in military to have beards and mustaches. It started in the Crimean War in the 1850s. European commanders started wearing facial hair, and it caught on instantly in Europe and spread to here. And so that's why people wore it. It was the more conservative thing for the men of power to be wearing facial hair at the time. to be clean-shaven as people like Wilson and others would be onward was to be quite radical in fashion policy. And speaking of changing fashion policy, when did men stop wearing hats? Who started that? Top hats, or just, you know, business hats. 1961, John F. Kennedy said, "I'm not going to wear them." And once the president stopped, then in all realms of fashion it stopped also, or was no longer considered inappropriate to not wear.
So was Lincoln considered a radical then?
He was, fashion-wise, yes. Because that was the very beginning of the new style, the new power of look, and new image. Well, yeah, he wore them. I'm trying to think back to before Lincoln.
The Washington?
They were still wearing wigs then. I can't think. The problem we have is we have no presidents that are photographed, I don't think. No, Buchanan was the first president photographed. Lincoln was the second. There's no paintings of top hats that I can think of, so maybe that's at the same time. Yeah. But I've always thought that would be a great course, wouldn't it? To study how housing, automobile, the transportation in general, clothing, facial hair, women's clothes styles, especially housing and architecture, reflected the liberal or conservative politics of the era. Don't you think? Hey, look at the 60s, those big, huge, wide ties, you know, the bell bottoms and kind of things, white sideburns, leisure suits, yeah. I really think that, and in the 80s, the more conservative era, those string ties came back again from the 50s. I think there really is some kind of a parallel between fashion and politics. Fashion and politics. I really think one leads the other. But don't you think that'd be an interesting, at least textbook, if not course, to read? And what kind of conclusions could you make? Why did, which led which? Yeah, did the civil rights spawn the Beatles or vice versa? That kind of argument. Well, civil rights were 50s, obviously before, but the idea and the ideology and thinking.
So did Lincoln just have like a total change of heart with that little letter from the little girl?
That's what we understand, that's an accurate story, that the girl, I think, she said he looked pretty bad, and so he was embarrassed by how bad he looked, so he grew the beard to try to cover that. I remember a story about someone asked, or was complaining that Lincoln was two-faced, and his response was, if I had another face, would I wear this one?
So we have radical presidents from the beginning, Lincoln had changed the heart, and then Lincoln on to Taft, or whoever had the last beard, radical back to it again?
Well, that's what I look at that wall and I say, when will the next facial, you know, haired president appear? It could be like Al Gore. That would be great. He's good at growing beards, good to run for president.
Well, if Hillary becomes president,
so Charles Evans Hughes might not be the last bearded.
Well, do you think
well,
to be seen so that they could be trusted, so that they weren't hiding?
I do wonder if, like you say, that if the progressive reform era, which leads into cleaning up government and business, actually suggests at the turn of a new century that a full, clean look is the modern, more efficient, democratic, special way of doing things. That could, yeah, could well be. Hard to say. Well, but anyway, it's an interesting area. But governors, that we were listing governors, is Hiram Johnson of California, Woodrow Wilson, who will become president later, of New Jersey, Charles Evans Hughes of New York, that's where I was, Hughes being the last bearded presidential candidate in 1916. He left the Supreme Court to be a Republican candidate, lost the election, was reappointed to the court in the 1920s, and by the 1930s was made Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And the irony here is, as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 1930s, New Deal laws, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal laws, will come into challenge for their constitutionality, and Hughes will write a number of conservative opinions arguing they're too liberal and they violate the traditions of the Constitution. Here he himself had been a progressive liberal in the teens, and now he's a more conservative element in the 1930s. So. Could be. It's the old classic Churchill comment that somebody, Giuliani, kind of bastardized recently about if you're not a liberal at age 20, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative at age 40, you have no head. Well, Giuliani said something about, he made it sound a lot worse if you're still a liberal, whatever it was. But I think Hughes didn't necessarily become more conservative. I think what we see here is the difference between progressivism in the teens and New Deal in the 1930s. Maybe a way to look at this is there's kind of three types of policies that traditionally are always bandied about, and this definitely isn't on the test, but it's just kind of worth thinking about, is if we think of three types of government policies are regulatory, distributive, and redistributive. Regulatory is when you pass a law that controls the behavior of some level of government or private business, like cleaning up pollution or regulating speed limits or something like that, or making tobacco illegal, something of that nature, the regulatory laws. Redistributive program, or first distributive programs, is where you take tax dollars to build a campus or a school or a road or a highway or give a college loan, etc. And redistributive policies, which may look mysteriously like the second one, is when you take money and give it to individuals for unemployment or Social Security or for aid to dependent children, etc. When you think of these kind of programs, progressivism only embraced the first one, regulatory. Why didn't, and we won't see the distributive and redistributive policies till the 1930s New Deal, the 1960s Great Society. Why weren't these redistributive or distributive policies in place during the progressive era?
Was it because it wasn't that perfect efficiency?
They would have seen that not as part of the perfect plan. They would have seen it, as you pointed out, too Marxist. That who has the right to take property from one and give it to another who has not earned it? That's what the distributive redistributive argument would be. So to stop corruption, to clean up government and make it honest, that's all right. That's not necessarily taking property from one and giving it to another. That's just making everybody play in a level playing field. So therefore, if Hughes came from the progressive era, he would only be in favor of laws that make a level playing field that don't redistribute wealth. And in the 1930s, a lot of the laws being challenged for their constitutionality had moved into the distributive-redistributive category. So it could be he turned conservative in an older age, or he came from a time period when to be a liberal meant only regulatory policy. That could be possibly the explanation. But anyway, famous politician Charles Evans Hughes, the most famous of the governors, or maybe Roosevelt's the most famous, but the most effective pioneers of progressivism is Robert La Follette, who is down here in item 44, and I haven't done 43 yet, but I'll come back to it in a minute. Robert La Follette of Wisconsin. I'll do 44, and then I'll come back and finish 43. That should confuse your notes. La Follette tried to run for governor as an independent in 1900 in Wisconsin. Not as a Republican. And was told by the state Republican machine that he had not kissed enough tails or paid the dues to be candidate, that there was a long line of other patsies ahead of him. Insulted by that, insulted by that, he chose to run anyway as an independent outside of the party protection and won. But he found that as governor, he was facing still a legislature in Wisconsin that was controlled by the old Republican machine. So when he ran for re-election in 1902, he suggested that others run as independents for the legislature. Let's get enough independents in the legislature and in the governor's state house to completely reform the corruptions of Wisconsin. And it worked. And eventually he created what he called his reform machine, in which if you get with my group and our group, we'll make sure you get elected as long as you're out there to stop corruption. Kind of a seeming irony of things. And it was La Follette who first pioneered these methods up here in 43. He's the first to come up with, and other states quickly followed what the Wisconsin idea or the Wisconsin plan embraced. He's also the first to use this brain trust concept. I talked about it working up to FDR later. It's not called the brain trust until the 1930s, but it's essentially the same thing, and that is the use of trained experts from local colleges and universities to manage state government departments. So here are going back to 43, here are some of the reforms at the state level that people like La Follette and the others we mentioned exercised. And I think I'll go with initiative first. It's at the end of the line, but it makes it easier to explain. An initiative is like a petition drive. If a state has an initiative law, it's such that when you get enough names on a petition, either the legislature is compelled to consider what that petition is asking for, or more often, the issue that is being brought up is referred back to the people on a ballot. And that's called a referendum. So instead of leaving it to the legislature of a state to make the law, which it may never do, you put it on a ballot for people to vote. Especially if these laws dealt with something like cleaning up corrupt politics, the people involved, mired in the corruption, are definitely not going to consider the law. But when it got to the people, they might. So there's behind all this is this belief and trust that the more the people have a voice, the more democratic things are, the more fair, just, and efficient it will be. Is that always true? Is putting more and more lawmaking on the ballots more fair and just and efficient? I'm not so sure either, because supposedly we elect representatives that know more about good governing than we do to make good law. And if it comes back to us on the ballot, we might just say, hang the Arabs. Ballot efficient, you know, initiative 25A is every Arab in the state of Arkansas shall be hanged. I mean, on 9/12, would that have been a passable amendment? Probably so. Would a legislature have done that? Less likely. You know, maybe they want to be reelected, but they're supposed to be thinking in terms of what's balanced and fair. So sometimes the more democratic something is, maybe it's not always more just and fair, maybe it's a little more mobocratic. But that wasn't, progressives wouldn't have liked to have heard me say those things. That wouldn't be with faith. The recall election is also a progressive reform measure pioneered at the state level. This is like a diselection, in essence. If you have someone who has been in office for a year or two, and they have like a 4-6 year term, or it's a 2-year term, they've been for 1 year, and they are considered malfeasant or have been involved in some kind of corruption, but they've got the system all set up so they will not get caught or get arrested, you could, if you had the recall law, put together through a petition drive, force them to stand for immediate election, where if they win the election, they keep their job. If they lose it, they're tossed out. The first time California went through a recall election, in the 1910s when they first came up with the recall measure through Hiram Johnson's efforts, was this recent one a few years back. Was it 2004, 2006, 2002 or 4? A couple of years ago when... 2005, so it was after Kerry had lost. Well, we all remember it as recently. But who is it going after? Gray Davis, governor of California. Was Gray Davis later convicted of any crimes or accused of crimes? No. So the original purpose of the recall was to get rid of malfeasant criminals, but it was used this time instead for what? Yeah, get rid of a policy person that we don't want. We can't wait for the next election. Let's make our change now. And that's what... And they also...
Was that
a recall election in Waldron? Did he win? Did he lose?
Yeah, he was trading favors.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember now. Yeah. Cheaper water bills for a service?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically no water bills for a service.
Okay, yeah.
Was that a recall? Or
did he undergo a recall? Or did he just get fired?
I think he just booted in.
Yeah.
It wasn't a matter of...
We had a mayor that... It seems like I have a memory. We talked about this already, didn't we?
I think we spoke about...
There was a mayor, Boguslavsky, that was accused of stealing trees off the Walmart parking lot.
Yeah.
We've talked about this, haven't we? Yeah. Oh, I know why we've talked about it, because it's another theme I'm going to address. How many of the populist agenda that didn't get accomplished in the populist period of the 1890s come to fruition now? So that's why it's memorable, because... Many of the things that the populist platform, such as high income tax, direct election of senators, recall measures, these things do get embraced a decade later in the 1910s. So that's one of the great themes of this, which kind of gives you a theme of life. What's not accomplished in populism some is accomplished in progressivism, more in the New Deal, more in the Great Society 60s. So if you're waiting around for national health insurance, hang in. That movement's coming.
So do you think
live on until it happens.
Like that the populist, everybody said the populist movement is kind of radical, and the older or the longer period of time,
becomes more accepted. Yeah, becomes more accepted. I think so. But I think we also lurch the other direction, too. I don't think it's always just a growing liberal country, because that's why we have conservative backlash periods, which was the ideas of a historian that recently passed. Did we talk about Arthur Schlesinger Jr.? We did already? Yeah, that was his theory was that America, since its inception, hasn't always just gone left, that it's gone through periods of conservative retrenchment and back to liberalism, back and forth. And so I think. But his argument is each time you go into a new liberal period, more is accomplished than what was before, or more changes, if you call that accomplishment. So, civil rights and things of that nature. And, of course, the California recall election not only got rid of Gray Davis, but at the same time set it up so that they could elect a new one, which they did with Schwarzenegger, which put the lieutenant governor of California, Bustamante, I think his name was, in an interesting situation. He wanted to support the party and support Gray Davis, so he campaigned for don't boot Gray Davis, but if you do, vote for me. And his name was on the ballot, but he didn't win it. Remember any other famous candidates in that election? There was a porn star. I can't remember her name. Gary Coleman was in that election. So. Is that her name? Yeah, Tracy. Yeah. Did I share the comment with you that Jay Leno said about Obama in California? Jay Leno was talking and he said that recently Obama had visited and campaigned in California, and he thought it was interesting that a son of a Kansas mother and a Kenyan father who had gone to school in Indonesia would campaign in a state where Hispanic voters elected an Austrian governor. So, kind of something to say about America. The direct primary, that would be an election in which voters, instead of machine politicians, choose the candidates. If the candidates were already corrupt, what chance did the people have for honest, good government? Well, here was the chance. If a state had a direct primary law, then an election would be held to choose party candidates. We've done this. We've done this again. So we know these things. Okay. Yeah, so the populace. So you know what a direct primary is. And you know what, all the Australian ballot, we've done that too. That's a secret ballot, guaranteeing the right that you can vote without being intimidated by employers, etc. So these things do all come to pass. And they start with La Follette, but it becomes faddish to have progressive reform in every state take place. These two cases in item 45 are Supreme Court cases which reflect the attitudes of the court at the time of progressive reform. Lochner versus New York in 1905 involved a law passed by the state of New York that restricted bakers, those who baked bread, bakers' hours to no more than a 10-hour day unless there was overtime pay. The Supreme Court took the side of the baking companies against the state of New York and argued that such a law violated the liberty of contract. That the state of New York's law violated the liberty of contract, meaning that if employers and employees, they had the right to negotiate for themselves how long they might work and how much they might work for, they violated both parties' choices to mandate that they have to be paid overtime for beyond 10 hours work. The Supreme Court. And this is a Supreme Court that, I think we already mentioned this, was very, very conservatively pro-property at this time. They were a court that would usually defend corporations against these regulatory laws like this. So while it might be a liberty of contract for both, what it's really saying is that bakers have the right to work their tail off. They're going to strike down all these protection laws. Mary Carey? Thank you for that contribution. I'll use that in future lectures.
Jesse, should we be worried
Thank God, I read it. There's a big write-up on MySpace about it.
Well, in a sense, so if you think about it, if 104 candidates of varied background like that can get into the election, isn't that the height of the democracy and opportunity, the people speaking through the California recall election?
Yeah, but do you think any of the more celebrity type people, they gained it more not on...
I mean, you're assuming they just wanted publicity rather than to be a public servant?
That's kind of like the U.S. going into the Brown Prince.
The Mueller versus Oregon case of 1908. This involved a state law in Oregon that said that women could not work more than 10 hours a day at either cottage industry work or in factories. Mueller versus Oregon said that women were, there was a law in Oregon saying women, whether it be at home in the cottage industry or whether it be in factories, were restricted to working no more than 10 hours a day, and this law was upheld. And so this is considered a plus for regulations protecting women from abusive working hours, but the reason it was argued is that women should, who have to care and nurture children and families, should be protected from the vicissitudes of harsh work society. So it's a sexist argument, but it is a protective law for the time period.
Where did the five-day work week come from?
Well, that's a good question. I would guess that the first time the five-day work week became standard would be in the 1930s, during the New Deal years. But that'd be worth looking up and finding. Progressivism works its way up to the national level in item 46 with the passage of these four amendments. And I've got kind of a pet theory about amendments in history. Usually amendments come in gaggles rather than by themselves. 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, obviously related to the Civil War and Reconstruction. Then 16, 17, 18 all here together. In 19, four in a row. Two more in 1930. Two or three in the 1960s. Rarely do you have just one amendment by itself, but often... more often there's two or three together in a given time period. You can either look at the time periods they're passed or just make a guess at it. What's that probably say about an era when there's two or three or four amendments being passed? Lots of change, lots of social and political upheaval demanding that the Constitution be reformed to fit the values of the time. So with four constitutional amendments passing, which is difficult to do when you think about the process of an amendment, because it may not be so hard to get it through two-thirds vote of both houses, to get it through the three-fourths of the state houses, that means enough of the country, both large and small populations, have to have a voice on this. And so four to get through, I think, illustrates, if nothing else, how much eventually progressivism became a spirit that most embraced. Even the fat cats who are being taken down have to look progressive in order to still stay in power. The 16th Amendment of 1913 provided for federal income tax. Again, something populists had advocated in their Omaha platform. Now, if you think from a 1930s, 1960s, or now perspective, why might reformers have advocated income tax? Especially progressive income tax. Yeah, to make the wealthy have to pay their fair share, and then after they pay, what do you do with the money? Yeah, so redistributive policy is what a lot of people think was the original intent of income tax, and it may have been for Marx, but it sure wasn't for progressives.
So this wasn't like a flat level income tax?
No, it's a very graduated. So the more you make, the higher the percentage would go up. Fun thing to do with the class is sit down and take some incomes, you know, 50,000, 500,000, 5 billion, et cetera, and start raising that income tax level. And see, when you're up to the 5 billionaire and you're taking 90% away from the 5 billionaire, leaving the poor guy with only $1 billion left to live on, you really quickly get to see where people are on this. Is that, oh gosh, but that's his property, or yeah, he needs to be controlled. That's a fun project to go into. But if it wasn't to redistribute money for spending for Social Security and welfare, what was it for? It was, yeah, to... Well, at the city level, there is some of that redistributive money. But a lot of the idea, and the sub-treasury plan comes in, a lot of the idea is that if you take the money from these people, you don't want to have government money influencing the economy, so you just put it somewhere and don't use it. And so the main purpose is not so much to redistribute the money as it is to put a cap on wealth itself, a maximum wage, in essence, would say. That seems so unproperty, free property for us, but the reason they'd want to put some kind of cap on wealth is the belief that, again, I've said this before, once you get through buying a hamburger franchise, buying a nation, you start buying politicians and governors and presidents and everything else, so therefore, putting a control on wealth democratized politics, or at least made it easier to do so. Somewhat akin to the idea of public financed elections, which we're, it looks like, moving away from, right? Because candidates now, in order to raise more money, are not taking the public funding. And so that leads us back to the complaint that only the super wealthy seem to be able to run or at least influence those who do. 17th Amendment. Direct election of senators, another accomplishment populists would applaud and claim they first advocated. 1913, same year, the 17th Amendment, direct election of senators. How were senators selected prior to 1913? The state legislatures would select them. So if your state legislature is in control of the machine politicians, then more than likely your national senate is too, which is why we called it the Millionaires Club, and how much more favorable these senators were to big business than the common ordinary people. So the belief is the more prestigious, powerful body, the Senate, needs to be directly elected by people, democracy, so that both houses are. Does that seem, I know we're assessing a 1913 amendment from a 2007 perspective, but does that seem appropriate? Is that what the founding fathers would have wanted? Obviously not. They would have made it that way. Why did the framers create a Senate that is not popularly elected?
Because back then no one was very educated.
Well, they made a House that was popularly elected. Pardon? There's a certain balance they wanted. The House would reflect, and it's the lower house, by the way, so you're right in that regards. They didn't want everything in the hands of the people. The House would reflect the idea that you do have a voice, but the upper house, the Senate, would cool off that voice by being people with a little more prestige and a little more removed from public pressure to make decisions for us. That's not very democratic. Is there any wisdom behind it? Well, let's just stop. Yeah. Somebody with more knowledge would be able to balance off the mobocratic House of Representatives. That's their thing. So, do we...
The Senate elect the candidates, and then the people elect who they want to have the candidates, or was it just the people elected all the candidates and then elected the people?
After 1913, you mean? Or in the beginning?
Back in the beginning.
In the beginning, we would elect our legislators to Little Rock, and they would choose in a legislative session who is the national senators. So is it better now the way it is, or should we go back to the intent of the founding fathers there? That's surprising. I think you'd jump right away with it's more democratic and fair to be able to elect our senators. So we need more effective campaign finance reform?
Yeah.
So here we are nearly a century later, fighting out the same issues of progressivism. It's in a different manner. Doesn't have to be that way.
Well, that's why they always say, you know, I'm for you, I'm like you, I'm a little man, I come from nothing. And then you turn around and, you know, they drive on Mercedes-Benz and you're driving a close to go.
They were, yeah.
Attorney General candidate Gunnar DeLay, Republican, spoke in front of my high school classes, and he said he was very much in favor of having all campaigns being publicly financed rather than by private money. Because he said that this is just so difficult and impossible for the common person to have a real serious chance at election. And I agree with that Republican. You'd have to have laws that put restrictions. Well, what's the biggest barrier to why you can't do that?
Because you have to get it passed by all the people who
Okay. And even if you find, yeah, that's true, but even if you got it passed, what would be the legal barrier after you got it passed, which might still have it tossed out. Violates the First Amendment. Violates freedom of speech. That's always the argument about campaign finance reform, that is it fair to tell me I cannot buy airtime or put up signs or pass out papers or something? There's a limit on how much you can collect, and the limits on how much you have to record where it came from and how many people, how much a person can give you. But once you have it, there's no limit on how much you can spend. Unless those new campaign finance laws, the McCain-Feingold law, put limits on it. But prior to that, there wasn't. There's a court case, 1976 Buckley versus Vallejo case, that said all these things. There's limits on how much you can collect. Not how much you can collect, but how much can be given to you, but you can spend whatever you get. So it's First Amendment versus public financing. It's an interesting argument. Got a few seconds left here. Let me do the 19th, then come back and leave the 18th for next time, because the 18th is such a wild story in and of itself. So far, can you see the 16th and 17th being in spirit with the watchwords of progressivism? They are, aren't they? Democratize. The 19th Amendment is very much democratization when you let more than half the people vote that exist. Women's suffrage. But it doesn't necessarily say give the vote to women. It says you cannot deny the right to vote. Well, it doesn't say right to vote. You cannot deny the vote on the basis of sex. So you might be denying it on something else, but not on gender in this case. That's what that one said. That's
1919.
Yeah.
They didn't get the right to vote until, was it World War I?
It's here, 1919.
It is.
You know what? Rather than going into, let's save that and progressivism for next time I come back, because I want to tell stories about the movement to get the women's suffrage, and people already have their hopes up by packing. In fact, they're already walking.
There's a movie about that, too.
That's real good ones, yeah.
The Iron Dog Angel.
I've heard of that. I've not seen it.
I think it was like an interview. It's about
the suffragette movement?
Yes.
Iron Jaws.
Iron Dog Angel.
That should be a Netflixable one. I don't want to get that from Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to show that in class.
No person is arguing against the campaign finance, though. It's the annual hearing.